And welcome to 360 North's Writer Showcase, our literary program that highlights work by Alaskan writers. I'm your host, Cheryl Snyder. Tonight, we'll hear five pieces that take us all over the state. We'll go from a beach in Southeast with Ernestine Hayes and Old Tom, and we'll sit by a fire with Dave Hunsaker on the Homer Spit. Each piece, in one way or another, is grounded in the experience of being in Alaska. We'll start off our readings with an essay by Christine Biles. Biles is a professional trail builder and author from Healy who recently published the book Dirt Work, An Education in the Woods, about her years working on trail crews for the National Park Service. Reading Bear Fragments, which originally appeared in the literary journal Brevity, please welcome actor Allison Holtkamp.
One. In the High Sierra, her first time sleeping in a tent, my friend Pilar from Barcelona is terrified. She is afraid of bears. She wipes toothpaste from the corners of her mouth, tucks her hair into the hood of her sleeping bag, and cinches it against cool alpine air. She stares at the nylon ceiling. She lies still as a log, attuned to any noise outside. All night she hears it. Rustle. Rustle, a bear in the bushes, edging closer to her, closer. She freezes, holds her breath. The noise stops. She relaxes. The noise begins, rhythmic, rustle, rustle. At 5 a.m., exhausted, her eyes drift shut and quiet. The sound is her eyelashes against the silky polyester of her sleeping bag. Open, shut, open, shut. She blinks, stops the rustle, starts it again, stops, starts. The bear is in her bag. She sleeps. Two. A Tlingit story tells of a woman who married a bear. From territory to region, village to clan to family, the story moves. Once I heard this. If you are a woman and a bear comes close, lift your shirt and show him your breasts. He will see you are a woman and remember your kinship. He won't hurt you. I have never had to try. Three. Northern Rockies grizzlies mate in early summer, lumbering towards lowlands in May, meeting up in meadows of glacier lilies just pushed up through snow. For weeks, they do little more than loll and hump and goose each other, frisky or dutiful as aging lovers. The boar gives sperm in great jets, but a sow does not become pregnant then. Her body protects a fertilized egg, unimplanted for months while she feeds, grows fat and slow on grub, moth, root, fish, beetle, seed. A bear cannot become pregnant before she is full. By late September, when food is leaving and the bear tires of gorging, the egg burrows into her uterine wall. The bear dens up. The cubs circle and twist inside of her. She breathes once, twice every few hours, her heart nearly stopped. Midwinter, cubs are born. For months in the den, they suck the sow's milk, grub, moth, root, fish, beetle, seed, while she lays on her side, dreaming of glacier-lilied fields. Four. Bear a grudge. Bear fruit. Bear your burdens. Bear down. Bear out. Bear arms. Bear the cost. Bear scrutiny. Bear left at the corner. Bear my grief. Bear a child. Bear up under pressure. Bear in mind. Bear witness. Bear north. Five. In Glacier National Park, I knew a photographer. One morning in an alpine meadow, Lester saw a bear across the hill, a dot on the horizon. It looked pretty far away. I had to squint to see it, he said. Lester photographed the bear as it came closer and closer, steady and steady. He yelled, but it came up to him and stood and looked at him, and Lester fell down and played dead like you're supposed to if a bear gets that close. The bear sniffed him and turned him over, ripped his skin open in long tears on his back, and licked him, and sat on his leg, blew out his knee, and crapped on his middle, a wet pile. The bear moved on. Lester can still hike, the wrecked knee fixed with metal plates. He still takes pictures in the mountains, awake to territory and perimeter. I don't blame that bear for a thing it did, he said. 6. While his sister wasn't watching, a young boy wandered off. His village was in a mountainous area in Pakistan, and the family worried. The boy, only 2. A search party looked for days without a sign. They were about to give up when one man found footprints outside a cave. Inside, the searchers saw the boy nestled with a bear, curled close to her side, both asleep. The men, entering the cave, woke the bear and they shot her and returned the boy to his family. At a hospital, he was examined. The boy had no scratches on him, not a single mark. In the boy's belly, the milk of a bear. 7. The scent of a bear is a thick, greased wind. Close, you can almost smell it right away. It precedes any other trace in the air. Blueberry or saw exhaust, spruce needle or wood smoke. Old and sharp, it brings to mind adrenaline and rot and sex and everything I've ever known to be wild.
Our next piece is written by former Alaska writer laureate Nancy Lord. In her essay, Zen Moose, Lord finds an unlikely convergence of a visiting moose family, Japanese poetry, and Bill Moyers. Please welcome our reader, actor Christina Apathy.
On an overcast evening in June, I was working in my upstairs bathroom, sanding walls for a coat of paint, when I was startled by a tremendous crashing in the alders just outside my opened window. I looked down at a cow moose with 2 copper as new pennies calves. The cow I recognized, an old girl with a scar on her right shoulder. I'd seen her earlier in the year with a grown calf. Her frolicsome new twins, perhaps 2 weeks old, now budded under her belly for noisy and energetic suckling. Mama grunted and went on tearing at the alders, grabbing a branch and sliding her mouth down its length so that she stripped it of leaves that ended as a wad against her lips and were promptly tongued in and swallowed. The 3 animals, between the dark wall of my house and the row of alders surrounded by grass and fireweed, were shielded from all the world, except for me, peering down like a bird from a nest. I put aside my sanding block and turned off the radio to watch the leaf stripping, the suckling, one of the calves biting tentatively at the top of some fireweed. The calves now and then bleated like young goats. The cow moaned as they tugged at her, then touched her great gray muzzle to their faces with what seemed, at least to me, like affection. Ken and I live in a downtown subdivision of a small Alaska town in a benchland area that was once the reserve of wintering and calving moose and is now populated with streets and houses. It was our conscious choice to not have a mown lawn of imported grass and ornamental shrubs, but to let the yard grow up again the way it was before the foundation hole was dug. Each spring, moose graze the new cow parsnip leaves at the base of the old stalks, and pine siskins flock through the alders and elderberry. At the start of summer, every year, Moose calves find their shelter in the shadow of the small house. It's an irony that though people increasingly displace moose and their usual sources of food, moose have also found comfort and safety among people. The moose in my yard, despite the threats of cars and free-running dogs, were safer in the heart of a human community than they would be in the wilderness. In Denali Park, where bears and wolves are active members of the ecosystem, only 10 to 20% of moose calves ordinarily survive their first year. In my town, twin calves routinely grow to maturity. The great obstacle to my urban moose would be finding enough to eat. Alder is definitely not a choice food, but the willow and birch moose favor were being lost to both development and overbrowsing. When winters are hard and the lowlands fill with more animals than the browse can support, moose lie down and die of starvation before our eyes. Feeding is not the answer. Every year, well-intentioned people put out carrots and bales of hay, but too often the sorry result is habituated aggressive moose that chase children at their bus stops and separate shoppers from their grocery stacks. While I fixed and ate dinner in my kitchen, the three moose lay outside my window near eye level. We were only 3 feet apart, clearly aware of one another, and I thought how odd it was that we all seemed to know that the pane of glass between us was impenetrable, that we inhabited utterly distinct, non-intersecting territories. I looked at the moose, and the moose looked at me. There's three sets of eyes, all the same size, enormous on the calves, sunken into the old cow's long face. The cow heaved when she breathed and looked less than robust. She was still shedding her winter coat, and her fur hung on her in pale, washed-out patches. The bones of her face and all along her back stood out, not from thinness, I thought, so much as age. She reminded me, more than anything, of an elderly pet mouse, thin-furred and arthritically angular, that I'd had as a child. Later, in the downstairs room on the opposite side of the house, I stretched out on the couch to watch a video, one of Bill Moyer's Language of Life series. Poet Robert Hass was reading haiku he translated from ancient Japanese. His words were accompanied by an odd series of whimpering grunts and rumblings. When I opened the blind, I found that the three moose had circled the house and were now bedded down in the grass outside this other window. I was about equidistant between them and the television and was receiving stereophonic sound. I stopped the video to study the moose again. The downy furred calves were nearly hidden in the grass, but the cow sat alertly, her head high, ears twitching and turning. In the western light, her heavily veined, translucent ears looked exactly like darkened cabbage leaves. I returned to the couch and video. The moose resumed making their noises. I stopped the video. They stopped. I started the video. They started. I realized that the calves sprawled in the grass were responding to the sound, the talk, the poet's richly soothing voice. The noises they were making were rhythmic, more than breathing, somewhat like snoring, like purring, but not like purring. I had a strange feeling that from the start, the animals had been drawn to my domestic tones, my radio and sanding, my cooking, and had followed me around the house to settle purposely beside the television. On the video, Hass read a haiku about a full moon and snails crying in a pan. And then he spoke to Moyers about the problem of finding the right word in English to translate what those snails were doing. While he was saying this, I was listening to the moose calves and trying to name their sound. It was not mooing and not mewing, but it was something like both. And then the correct word came to me. The young moose were mewling. In his next breath, Hass said that perhaps the best word to describe the sound made by the snails in the pan was mewling. I could only shake my head in amazement. What inexplicable moment was this? that Bill Moyers, Robert Haas, an ancient Japanese poet, and three moose in my yard could engage me in a single conversation. In a salon of my own making, I had met the language of life exactly.
Comes to us from Captain Bill Hopkins of the Alaska Marine Highway System. Precipice of the Deep is a true account of events that unfolded on January 30th, 1994. We join the story just after the MV Matanuska has emerged from a dense fog that had obscured visibility for most of the day and through the night. Hopkins focuses this next portion of the tale on a young couple heading out for an afternoon outing in their skiff. Reading Precipice of the Deep, please welcome Brandon Demery.
Fog began to lift, and Herman gave Angeline her short notice. In his rush to get underway, Herman boarded his skiff, pulled on the starter cord, and the new engine, started up without any effort. He dressed lightly and did not bring oars, life jackets, extra clothing, a spare engine, flashlights, toolkit, a VHF radio, flares, or a bilge baler. After all, it was only a test run. There was no food on board, but he did bring his high-caliber bolt-action rifle. Angeline's grandmother would prepare the dinner and perhaps have a warm red huckleberry pie on her kitchen table waiting for them to celebrate their arrival. Angeline put on her rubber boots and followed Herman down the dock ramp. At his direction, she sat on the forward bow thwart with her back toward the wind, facing Herman sitting on the stern. One thing she always carried as a matter of habit was a box of matches, wrapped inside a plastic sack to keep them dry and stored in her coat pocket. Herman bent over to check the fuel level in the gas tank. It was full to capacity with oil-mixed gasoline. Running smoothly, Herman's new engine pleased him, and he smiled at Angeline sitting on the bow. Her long, dark hair blew aft toward Herman, who remained on the stern thwart with his hand on the engine throttle and tiller. Angeline returned a smile to Herman and her admiration. He had worked hard to save enough money to purchase the engine. She was grateful, finally, to be on her way to Klemtu. Clear of the harbor, Herman opened the throttle to full speed, lifting the bow. The engine's propeller bit into the water and the stern came down. An energetic thrust stream and vessel wake passed astern. There was little freeboard between the low-cut transom and the surface of the water where the engine was mounted. As long as Herman kept his vessel moving forward at a fast rate, there was little danger of any water entering into the boat. Along the way, they met few boats. It was though the country were empty of any humanity. Passing the Dryad Point Lighthouse, they sped away into the Canadian wilderness for Klemtu and Grandmother's house. Having made the trip many times in the past, this one promised to be different. With a new and more powerful engine, it would take less time. Herman calculated it would take an hour and 45 minutes to cover the distance instead of the usual 3 hours it used to take in the past with his older, less powerful engine. Scanning the horizon ahead for logs, driftwood, or floating kelp, Herman watched the water attentively. Seabirds scattered out of their way, too filled with small feeder fish for any easy liftoff. The sky cleared, though patches of fog lingered here and there. They expected to arrive in Klemtu before nightfall descended. A strong scent of cedar filled the cold air as they meticulously followed the planned route. Leaving the shelter of Marilla Passage, they struck out across the top of Milbank Sound to Jorkins Point, the southern point of Swindle Island and the entrance to Finlayson Channel. Following along the rocky shoreline, Herman proceeded to Swindle Point. Rounding Swindle Point, the summit of 1,285-foot-high Cone Island came into view. Locally known as the China Hat, this distinctive peak was an aid to navigation to show the way toward the nearly invisible, shadow-covered Klemtu Passage along its left side, a narrow and deep but through waterway leading to Trout Bay and the settlement of Klemtu. Perched along the western shore of Klemtu Passage, Angeline could not wait to get to grandmother's house. With a China Hat in sight, their destination was not far and almost in hand. But she and Herman had become cold in the sharp January air. A skiff, 15-knot northeast wind greeted them. In the 44-degree Fahrenheit temperatures, the chill factor felt as though it were 25 degrees. Seas were rising into a short, nasty chop. Herman slowed his craft down to lessen the possibility of making a drenching sea spray and the effects of a low chill factor. Adjusting the throttle downward, the engine coughed and stalled and fell silent. Visions of being in the warmth of her grandmother's house vanished, and the skiff drifted to a stop. All that could be heard were wind, sea, and Herman cursing at his engine. Pulling on the starting cord, the new engine refused to start. With Klemtu hidden behind China Hat, but nearly in sight, the skiff turned into the wind with her stern up into the wind and her bow pointing downward like a weather vane. Angeline and Herman began a slow drift southward, where the wind and the ebbing tide would take them, down Finlayson Channel and out into Milbank Sound toward the open Pacific Ocean. Perhaps it was a simple something faulty, a spark plug, a plugged fuel filter. Herman had no tools. With no spare engine or oars, he could not maneuver his boat to keep her bow into the wind by motoring or rowing toward Klemtu. Without a VHF radio, he could not call for help. Without any flares, he could not signal other vessels. Without any bilge pump, he could not pump the water slopping into the boat over the low-cut transom stern. A choppy sea battered the stern, spilling seawater into the boat. Water levels in the bilge rose slowly, eventually immersing their feet in cold water. Angeline and Herman both could have removed their boots and used them to scoop the water and pour it overboard, but apparently this did not occur to them. Seawater continued slopping over the transom stern, and little by little the water became deeper inside the boat. With no other vessels in sight, with no life jackets to don, drifting farther from land, Herman and Angeline's lives were now in peril. Perhaps the engine was only flooded with extra gasoline and needed some time to drain and dry before attempting to start it again. Herman waited an appropriate amount of time and tried once more to start his new engine. Putting extra effort in pulling on the starting lanyard as though it may help, but regardless, the engine would not start. As Herman worked on the engine, the water level gained on the boat. The China Hat disappeared from view beyond Jorkin's Point. Soon they were out in the open spaces and depths of Milbank Sound, drifting in the north wind and a south flowing ebb tide. They shivered, and as the water level in the boat rose, the skiff's freeboard decreased, allowing even more water to spill into the boat. Feeling a slight ocean swell, it was only a matter of time before their craft would be swamped, and they would be left struggling to stay afloat in the cold waters of the North Pacific Ocean. A red sky offered a beautiful sunset as they watched the sun dip below the horizon of the Pacific Ocean, but this was of no comfort, nor was it a time for taking in the wonders around them. Water crept up their legs, soaking their feet and clothing. Darkness came swiftly, with a night sky illuminated with thousands of twinkling stars shone brightly above them. Shivering increased, and soon their movements were uncoordinated and their speech became slurred. Herman encouraged Angeline and continued to try starting the stubborn engine. Moonless, except complete darkness surrounding them, and no lights were in sight except for the regularity of the Vancouver Rock whistle buoy just to the west of the rock. The buoy's whistle, activated by the slight ocean swell, was heard faintly, but otherwise they were alone. To the southeast, the manned ivory island lighthouse beacon was seen rotating in the distance. Without any radio communications, those who staffed the lighthouse were unaware of Angeline and Herman's predicament. Herman was preoccupied with the engine to no avail. Angeline was angry at the quandary she now found herself in. Time had no meaning. And after drifting 4 hours and 9 miles, hope withered. Her hands had turned numb. Water crept up her pant legs like a siphon, and she could feel the boat sinking into the black sea. She stared overboard into the precipice of the deep. North wind and choppy seas continued unabated with lethal consistency. Water crept upward inside the skiff in an apparent losing battle. There was no delaying the inevitable. Herman's efforts produced not even an engine belch. Despair overwhelmed Angeline. Reaching into her coat pocket, she felt the packet of matches she had placed there earlier. They would do no good in the middle of Billmake Sound. Other than the sound of the northerly wind, it was a quiet night. A choppy sea pelted the stern, and water continued slopping over the low-cut transom, filling the boat. No other vessels were in sight. Their only companions were the multitude of stars, with the sweeping light of the Ivory Island Lighthouse on the southeastern horizon. With the temperature dropping 10 degrees as soon as the sun had set, wind chill and cold soon overcame any sensations of warmth. If only we had a radio to call the lighthouse or flares to be seen, thought Angeline. A sharp eye detects motion quickly. Herman, with his head down, working on the engine, did not look up and scan the horizon. Angeline did, however, look around and scan the horizon with her sharp eyes. Angeline kept her thoughts to herself. We'll soon sink and disappear from the face of the earth. Despairing, she looked around in the event that there may be a passing boat. These surveys had been an exercise in disappointment, but this time her eyes caught the motion of white lights exiting from Seaforth Channel into Millbank Sound, very near the Ivory Island Lighthouse. Unsure what it may be, she watched intently. Herman, I think I see a ship coming our way. Herman stopped his work for a moment and looked in the direction that Angeline had pointed. There, just passing the Ivory Island Lighthouse, were the masthead range lights of a large ship. A lower forward masthead light, followed by a higher aft masthead light, a starboard side green side light, became visible. Indicating that the ship was turning, the range lights closed and then opened up again, but this time to reveal a port side red light. The ship had changed course at Susan Rock, proceeding northward toward the area of their drifting boat. Herman estimated that he and Angeline were still too far away to be noticed on a dark night as this. In despair, he said, "They'll never see us." Thinking quickly, Angeline reached into her coat pocket and pulled out her box of dry matches. Taking off her jacket, she said, "Herman, douse my jacket with some gasoline. I've some matches." Grasping the idea, Herman disconnected the gas line hose from the engine. Angeline, not wanting to walk aft in the nearly filled boat and upset its tender stability, tossed the jacket to Herman. Catching the flying jacket before it landed in the water, he hand-pumped the priming bulb and squeezed gasoline onto the jacket, soaking it well, but leaving a sleeve dry for Angeline to use as a torch handle. Herman cautiously threw the gas-soaked jacket toward the bow. Landing next to Angeline on the thwart, she picked it up and felt in the dark for the sleeve that was still dry. She waited until she thought the approaching ship was close enough to see her distress signal. "I think they're close enough now," she said to Herman. Herman concurring, saying, "Light up that coat, Angeline. We've not much time." Striking a match on the side of her matchbox with numb fingers was no easy task, but the match ignited immediately. She cupped the nascent flame in her cold hands to prevent the wind from blowing it out. Cautiously, she touched the smaller flicker to her jacket. It exploded into a fury of orange flame. Bravely, Angeline grabbed the dry sleeve and began to twirl the burning coat above her head. "Hey! Over here! Can you see us?" she shouted into the dark night, as though expecting someone on the ship to hear her voice. Several rapid twirls of the flaming jacket were made above Angeline's head, illuminating their small boat in a rotating glow. Angeline's eyes flashed bright and intense, looking directly toward the MV Matanuska. Her wind-tossed hair trailed forward toward the open Pacific Ocean. Burning and melting, the jacket was quickly consumed, and with one last desperate twirl, Angeline let it fall into the sea before it burned her hand. Making no apparent reaction, the Matanuska continued with her northward track. "I'm not sure they've seen us," she screamed. Taking off her shirt, she tossed it to Herman. It was all or nothing, life or death. "Douse it!" Herman doused the shirt in gasoline as before, being careful to leave one sleeve dry. He threw the shirt back to Angeline, sitting cold in her bra. With numb and shaking fingers, she again pulled another match from her matchbox and struck it on the side of the matchbox. Touching it quickly to the shirt, it ignited into a ball of spectacular, life-giving flame. For a few briefer moments than before, Angeline twirled her burning shirt above her head. "Can you see us, ship?" she cried. "Look our way, please!" Consumed quickly in the heat of the flame, Angeline dropped the remains of her shirt into the sea. Profound darkness and silence closed in on the hapless couple. Herman was getting ready to soak his jacket with gasoline when, at the last moment, Angeline and Herman could see the ship changing its course. Both the forward and the after masthead lights lined up in range, one above the other in line, and both port and starboard side lights were now seen. Bright beams of searchlighting soon pointed in their direction. The ship was coming toward them. Four long blasts of the ship's whistle resonated across the waters of Millbake Sound. Blast echoes struck Angeline and Herman's ears at the same time. It was music. "They've seen us?" "Oh, thank God," said Angeline. "They're coming toward us."
We'll post that story in its entirety on our website, where you can read about the rescue and the new engine's fate. Our next guest, Dave Hunsaker, is widely known as a playwright and screenwriter, but tonight he uses prose to introduce us to a 20-something version of himself. He's one of two Vietnam vets living on the Homer Spit after the war, trying to find solace in the land, the water, the fish, and a woman. Reading his piece, Homer Spit, 1972, please welcome Dave Hunsaker.
A driftwood fire in the rain makes a very distinctive smell. It mingles sweetly with the smoke of the dope George scored in Anchorage, which Amy says is called Matanuska Thunder something. She seems too embarrassed to say something what. Amy and Alana think it's a pretty big deal, but George says it's nothing compared to the stuff he and I used to smoke. He doesn't say where. "We have jaded palates," I say. "The hell you mean by that?" says George with disgust, and I go quiet. What else beside the smoke? The smell of wet wool off the sweater I'm wearing, a hand-knit gift from my sister. An unknowable rich scent when I lean close to say something to Amy. Her shampoo, maybe. Some new brand I'm not familiar with. Patchouli oil, vanilla behind her ears like the girls in high school used to wear, maybe. I don't know. I've been away too long. Familiar, unfamiliar. Whatever it is, it makes something ache sweetly down in my deepest, most secret self. What else? The sappy, sticky, sweet smell taste of the Yukon Jack that George passes me. Weeks ago, when he first started buying it, I asked him, why the hell are we drinking this stuff? 'Cause we in Alaska now, he said solemnly. You mean like when in Rome? We sure as hell ain't in Rome. It's just the same. When you in some other country, man, you drink what the people drink. Like tiger beer, I asked. Yeah, said George, looking me in the eye. Like tiger beer. What else? No, that's enough. It's our third night by the fire with Amy and Alana. We met them 4 days ago when they pitched their tent next to George's and mine. We have been camped here on the Homer Spit for well over a week. So by the time they arrived, we had become old hands. We helped them to build a driftwood barricade against the prevailing wind and showed them how to rig a second rainfly out of visqueen against the ocean damp. We figure all that knowledge makes us local heroes. They told us they were nurses at a hospital in Anchorage, and I made some lame crack about how we should put a red cross on their tent, and George shot me that look, and I shut up. Naturally, they have their own car, and last night they drove into town for dinner, and I missed them by the fire. I talked about them too much, and George told me to knock it off. It wasn't all that hot anyway. But it wasn't so. They were beautiful. I didn't say anything, but I'm pretty sure he was only saying that because he thought he didn't have a chance with them or didn't have the energy to try anything. So after supper, George and I went up to the Salty Dog for a beer. The place was crowded with fishermen, and I couldn't find anywhere to sit down. George played pool while I drank beer and watched. A couple of fishermen appeared not to like us, and I was taking their measure, wondering if this was going to be like that time at the NCO club in Da Nang with the guys from Bravo. I was wondering how I would do, but this time George stayed cool and ignored them. He held the table for 6 games straight, but then he saw that my leg was giving me trouble from standing, so we left their quarters on the table and went back down to our tent and our fire. We drank Yukon Jack, and I talked about Amy and Alana some more. Now tonight they're back with us, and it's raining, and it is very good in our smoke. Best of all, I think I see the signs from Amy, things I remember from 2 years ago when I was still part of the real world. George is being a perfect gentleman, which he always is in the presence of ladies. They're kind of hippie chicks, Amy and Alana, and I can tell they think it's cool that a black man and a white man are as good as friends as George and I obviously are. They ask us how we met, but George just says, we go way back. Our brilliant disguises are coming along pretty well. George's hair is starting to blossom into a respectable afro, and mine is as long as I've been able to get it in 4 months. I'm disappointed with my beard, though. George has come in much better. He still wears his old olive drab field jacket because it's the only coat he owns, but what the hell? Lots of people wear them. I have my sister's sweater and a very fine down vest I spent good money on at a mountaineering store in Spinard. Amazingly, George and I had no trouble hitching a ride down here from Anchorage. Some Texans in a van picked us up, and George told them they needed me to guide them to Homer because I had been here once before. They pretended to go along with that, even though I'm pretty sure they knew that on the whole route there is only one intersection to speak of. George and I have come to Alaska because I am curious and romantic and seem to have no place else on earth to go, and because he wants to catch fish. At first, I would try to fish with him, but I quickly became self-conscious because I knew my leg was holding him back. Now I'm happy to hang around wherever we are camped, strumming my guitar and making up songs and cooking dinner. I'm a lousy cook, but George pretends to like what I give him. Usually he has a salmon, and we eat it for supper and for breakfast, along with whatever else I've been able to scrounge. Tonight, I barbecue George's fish of the day for Amy and Alana. Alana hardly touches hers, but Amy says it's scrumptious, which is in itself one of the signs I was talking about. Before we came up here, I was 3 months in Madigan Hospital trying to learn to walk again. George finished the tour, then came and got me. Now we are camped on the Homer Spit for an altogether indefinite length of time. The clouds and mist and drizzle gather around us, and the late August summer is waning noticeably. Tonight, I know somehow that it will get darker than it has since we came to Alaska. Signs of things to come. Alana has one more toke, then says goodnight and goes off to sleep in the Red Cross tent. It's maybe 10 o'clock. George waits not more than 3 minutes, then he goes too, back to our tent, Little Blue, we call it. He is a gentleman, a Virginia gentleman, of perfect discretion. Maybe I already said that. Now, finally, I am free to speak to Amy from my heart, pour out all my dreams and hopes about Alaska, all about the future, north to the future, says her license plate, with no mention of the past. No mention. She's a good listener. I slyly let the fire burn down to embers, and she scoots closer. My heart is so full right now, I think it could burst. Hours we spend there, hours and hours. And now this. I crawl into Little Blue. George is sound asleep, I can tell by his breathing. I slept beside this man for so long now, I know everything about his sleeping. I know, for example, that he's an even lighter sleeper than I am, so I don't even have to speak or make a sound. Sure enough, he awakens. Yeah? Look, man, I need the tent, I say. He blinks himself the rest of the way awake. Damn, I never thought you stood a chance. It's still raining, I say apologetically. That's all right, fish bite good when it's raining. I crouch there in the tent as he pulls on his pants. I am aware of Amy alone by the fire, but right now I need to know that all is cool with George. He puts on his field jacket and he takes up his casting rod and some pixies. He crawls out of his tent, leaving his sleeping bag warm from his body. I owe you, man, I say. Damn right, he says. And his grin tells me everything's okay. I limp back to Amy by the fire and I watch as George makes his way down to the whispering surf. I watch as he takes his first cast. Nick Adams with an afro, I think to myself. Always the goddamn would-be English major. Then I lead Amy to the tent, and inside it gather her in my arms, and maybe the scent of her, and the touch of her, and the big generous heart of her will bring me the peace I have been hoping for all this long time. And maybe there's a silver salmon out there someplace, swimming in the black nighttime waters of Kachemak Bay, that will do the same for George, will feed us, and somehow help us all to make sense of the world once again.
Our final reader this evening belongs to the Kagwantan, or Wolf Clan, on the Eagle side of the Tlingit Nation. She is known to many as a teacher, an activist, and the author of Blind Indian. Tonight, we get a glimpse into the sequel of that book, reading from her new work, The Tao of Raven. Please welcome Ernestine Hayes.
Regret and the forest are patient teachers. We live in shadows. We live in the shadows of women who, if they were features of landscape, would be the tallest mountains, the widest rivers, the deepest part of our literary oceans, while we cling to narrow shores, while we wade in ankle-deep shoals, while we bluster at barnacles. We live in the shadows of men whose words paint the wings of the brightest songbirds and echo the most lyrical rustlings of the forest. We haunt the near borders, listening, hoping one day to understand, to hear their message, to believe. We imagine ourselves swimming out beyond safety into the deepest waters. We are here to become one another. All our lives we have been forced to study and practice how to be someone else. And all our lives those others have imagined themselves as us. We live in each other's shadows. I was taught by my Tlingit grandmother to see the world through an indigenous lens. As a student in the years that followed, I was taught to see the world through a colonial lens. As the only child of a single mother who loved to read, I learned at an early age the pleasures of imagined escape through the page into another world. As the first grandchild of a no-nonsense woman who perceived the world in the old way, I listened to her stories and learned to recognize that everything is alive and everything is connected. My mother drank Hill's Brothers coffee. She smoked Pall Mills. She shuffled worn blue cards and dealt bicycle hands of Pinnacle and Canasta, poured herself a cup of steaming Joe, flashed an etched Zippo with a quick snap, the one bit of her memory she let me see, the one remnant of her memory from which I built an imagined ghost to call my father. She planned budgeted orders from Sears and Montgomery Ward catalogs, two pleated skirts, three pastel blouses, four pair of pink-laced anklets. No shoes this year, no winter coat, no beads, no feathers, no history. We shopped for mail order acceptance following send-away instructions. We searched for our mislaid culture in shelved boxes of pilot bread. Sailor Boy, Tang, Libby's corned beef, traditional foods of our colonized cupboard. Someone is living my life. Someone knows my song. Someone casts a shadow as I stand here dreaming that I write. As I stand here wondering about a place called Saginaw Bay, a place called Flounder Hill, a place called We Also Cherish Words That Remind Us of Our Ancient Ones, a place called But This Is the Way It's Always Been Done. Old Tom walks along the beach. Low tide has set the table. He hopes for clams, urchins, maybe a crab. This part of the beach, a hidden button of a cove that only he knows, has never yielded much in the way of bounty, but on a mild afternoon with a few clouds reflected in the tide pools and amidst the thick, rich stench of the beach, it makes a fine day. Old Tom builds a fire. It's been a few years now since old Tom lost his son. A few years since word came that young Tom's skiff had been found and no sign of young Tom. Only his wrinkled campsite, only the ashes of his fire, only the now empty places that young Tom's body once filled, the empty air where his voice once rang, the empty promises young Tom always meant to keep. Old Tom never thinks about the moment he heard the news without experiencing again the immediate cold dread that erupted from his groin through his belly into his chest and pierced his suddenly sober mind. He'd like to say he never drank again. He'd like to say he drank until the funeral and never drank after that. He'd like to say he sobered up a few weeks or a few months later for the sake of the memory of his son. But he kept drinking until the doctor at the Indian clinic told him it was get sober or die, and after three more benders where getting drunk made him sicker than staying sober and drinking was no longer the way to get well, old Tom got sober. And now he walks along the beach and thinks of days and nights and laughs and smiles and kisses and women and snow and cold and warm salt water and his son, his only son, his boy, his baby boy, young Tom. After young Tom had married Mabel, it looked like there would be a family in the family after all. A place where old Tom could say he could go on holidays like Thanksgiving and Easter. A place to think about when he shivered in an abandoned car on a cold night and crooned love songs to the darkness, feeling sorry for himself and missing the one woman in the world who for a while before she died had said she loved him. A place that formed the picture of a granddaughter and a son and a woman named Mabel to hold on to, like the thought of white people's heaven to the unsaved. Thank you. Good night, Chase.
That's all we have time for this evening. We'd like to thank our writers, Ernestine Hayes, Dave Hunsaker, also Christine Bile, Nancy Lord, and Bill Hopkins. Also, thank you to our actors, Brandon Demery, Allison Holtkamp, and Christina Apathy. For more information on our writers and actors, to rewatch the program, or to learn how you can submit to Writer Showcase, please go to 360north.org. That's all we have time for. Thanks, and good night.
Funding for Arts at 360 comes from Northwind Architects and Rainbow Foods of Juneau.